The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's great to be with you here on this beautiful afternoon here at Edstone, right in the middle of the week, and with so much to get to on today's program. Today's March 11th, by the way, the anniversary, I guess this would be 31 years, the 31-year anniversary of the 1150 days coming to an end, that bracket of time between January 16th, 1986, and March 11th, 1989, when God began to reign, spiritually speaking, upon his people yet again. You can read about that in Daniel 8 and verses 13 through 14, where it talks about the 2,300 sacrifices, as it should read, and you can see that in the Revised Standard Version, but it's talking about 1,150 days. The truth being cast to the ground, but then God responding, and you look at the work that's been done. You look at what God has raised up since that time, March 11th, 1989, and well, now we've had over 30 years of history, and we've seen abundant fruit. We've seen all kinds of precious fruit that's come forward as we've raised up the work and reprinted and distributed Mr. Armstrong's writings, his books, his booklets. We've started in on television, before that radio, now television and radio. The college, of course, was established in 2001, and so many events since that time over the course of these past three decades. Now the work is a worldwide work for sure. A small group scattered about as well, but a worldwide work, and one that's looking to expand into Jerusalem here before the end of this age as well. Yesterday, I talked about the importance of travel when it comes to our education, and Mr. Armstrong, of course, stressing that during his ministry, saying that education, among other things, we're educated by our travels, and we'll finish that study in the second segment of today's program. But first, some of the headlines that stood out for us, the news gatherers this morning. Joe Biden won the, I guess they're calling it the Super Tuesday 2, the second Super Tuesday. And as you might have heard there at the top of the hour, it wasn't but just a couple of weeks ago when his campaign was practically dead in the water, and now it's looking like Bernie Sanders' campaign is pretty much finished. I think it was Van Jones on one of the programs last night saying that now the Democrats, they've got their work cut out for them to just try to unify the party, because there's quite a few Sanders supporters that are very upset at what they see yet again as cheating. They feel like it's been pulled out, the rug's been pulled out from under Sanders. And so now the Democrat establishment, excuse me, they're all in. They're all in for Joe Biden. Last night on Tucker Carlson's show, he had Glenn Greenwald, who was talking about just how dramatic things have changed here in the last couple of weeks, when everyone started going all in on Joe Biden. And as Greenwald points out here, it was Barack Obama really working behind the scenes that began to turn the tables in the direction away from Bernie and over to Joe Biden. This is that exchange between Glenn Greenwald and Tucker Carlson last night on Fox, clip one.
as somebody who began focusing on Joe Biden just a couple of weeks ago in earnest when, you know, remember his campaign was left for dead when he had a fourth place finish in Iowa and then a fifth place finish in New Hampshire. His funders were fleeing. And then suddenly it all turned around with a phone call or two. Barack Obama got the Democratic Party with extraordinary obedience, almost creepy like discipline to snap into line behind him. He became the consolidated frontrunner. People began paying attention and I began writing and others did too. Wait a minute, there's something seriously wrong with his cognitive faculties. That's a big deal for electability and for governing.
That's Glenn Greenwald last night talking to Tucker Carlson. The end there, he's talking about some of the misstatements that Joe Biden has made in recent weeks and how that, I guess he's now 77 years of age, and the two of them talked about how that his cognitive faculties, it should be a consideration. There were so many in the media and Democrats, of course, just a few years ago that were making a huge deal out of that for Donald Trump. But now you see this candidate and they're all in on him and you wonder if this is going to backfire. They couldn't take Bernie because he's an open and proud communist. And so they have to settle on the establishment candidate. And he's definitely lost a step or two over the last decade or so. And yet, they're all in. They're all in. And Barack Obama is working the phones in almost a creepy kind of way. Think of what my father wrote. This I drew attention to the April issue of The Trumpet yesterday. The one right before it, as I've drawn attention to before, is the March issue on being fundamentally transformed. Impeachment, socialism, and the America's lurch left. In the age of Trump, and there have been reports, there was another one, I'll play the clip here in just a second, but this Axios report on how that Joe Biden's already talking about preparing his cabinet, and he's going to bring back so many of the same people that played such crucial roles in the Obama administration. He's campaigning, you could say, on a return to normal. You heard there, one of his catchphrases is a return to decency. So he's going to go after President Trump's lack of morality the way that he sees it. And return to normal. In other words, return to the way that it was during the Obama years. Sally Yates, Susan Rice, John Kerry. These are all potential members of a future Joe Biden cabinet. Here's how Fox News reported on that development, this story from Axios yesterday, clip two.
Former Vice President Joe Biden reportedly lining up or talking about candidates for his cabinet already. And according to a report in Axios, some high-profile possibilities include a litany of former Obama officials. So do voters really want a blast from the past? Here to discuss, Fox News contributor Charles Hurt. Charlie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
All right, so I'm going to go through some of them. Some of the former Obama officials considered, according to Axios, Susan Rice as Secretary of State, John Kerry running climate change, Sally Yates as Attorney General. Then some of the former 2020 candidates, Elizabeth Warren, maybe for Treasury, Mike Bloomberg, head of the World Bank, Pete Buttigieg as UN Ambassador or Trade Rep.
So some of the candidates that were running for president this year, and then quite a few others, as you just heard there, John Kerry, Sally Yates, Susan Rice, and so on, that are throwbacks to the Obama years. That report, by the way, the Fox report there, it went on to talk about how that Biden is presenting himself as the safe candidate, and how that he's trying to, well, I think it was Charlie Hurt in that exchange with the Fox News commentator who said that if not for President Trump being elected, there would be none of this. This deep state would have been exposed. And so here comes Joe Biden, and now he's campaigning on putting the monster back together, is the way Charlie Hurt put it. You know, resurrecting this deep state. It's a war, America at war with itself, as we've had with one of our headlines in the past. But NBC talked about the quiet hand of Barack Obama He's working behind the scenes. You go back to a couple of weeks ago when Pete Buttigieg dropped out of the race, followed by Klobuchar, and how that was all instigated by a phone call. A phone call by Barack Obama in that March issue of The Trumpet. My father talks about the dark arts of the Obama administration. He pulls that phrase from Andy McCarthy's book, Ball of Collusion, the plot to rig an election and destroy a presidency. And McCarthy in his book says that no administration in American history was more practiced in the dark arts of politicizing intelligence than President Obama's. He weaponized these intelligence agencies. And the carryover, it continued even after President Trump's inauguration, as they worked to, even as recently as a few weeks ago, to destroy this presidency. And so here is the Antiochus administration, as I've noted a few times before, not going away. The war is not over. Here's what Andrew Yang, he also was running for president earlier in the primaries. He came out yesterday and endorsed Vice President Biden, and as most of prominent people in the Democrat Party have done. And this is what he had to say last night, clip three.
We all know when Joe becomes our president, he's going to bring back many of the Obama alums who are really, really competent and technocratic, and that there's going to be real hunger for that in the days to come among many, many Americans if the coronavirus crisis continues to grow. Well,
that's Andrew Yang talking about the Obama technocrats coming back with a potential Joe Biden presidency, the return of the deep state. Chuck Schumer, if you go back to, this is a clip we've played before, but if you go back to the start of President Trump's presidency, even before, during those transition months, when he was president-elect, he was criticizing the intel community with some tweets, as we now know that he does quite often. But he started in on that early on. And this was Chuck Schumer, in a moment of crystal clear clarity, saying to Rachel Maddow how that if you mess with the intel community, they will get you back one way or another. They'll get you back. How prescient that turned out to be. Here's Chuck Schumer from January of 2017, clip six.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. So even for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, he's being really dumb to do this.
And that certainly did happen. They have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. Of course, Donald Trump has fought back. And the war, as I say, it continues. This piece at Red State, I thought this was fascinating as well. It's about how President Trump has slowly but surely been moving to take control of the intelligence apparatus that the Obama administration weaponized to force President Trump from office. That was its ultimate goal for Brennan, Clapper, Comey, and all those guys. They were using those agencies or trying to influence them after some of them stepped aside and went right into their posh jobs at CNN or MSNBC. To force President Trump from office. But it just goes through what's happened in the last couple of years. This is at redstate.com. It says the first step was retirement of Dan Coats. This was not a huge deal, but if you recall, there was a huge outcry from the people most closely associated with the Russian hoax and the intelligence leaks that federal law required that Coats be succeeded by Coates' principal deputy, Sue Gordon. So Coates steps down. He was the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. He steps down. By law, they have to then hand it over to his principal deputy, Sue Gordon. And this article brings out how that the administration then forced her retirement. So that then brought in Joseph McGuire. And then by the time the impeachment was over a few weeks back, it was pretty clear McGuire wasn't going to be a Trump loyalist. And so they forced him out or pushed him out as well. And that's what led to the interim or acting director, Richard Grenell. And he came in. I think he was the ambassador to Germany. He comes in. He's a devout Trump loyalist for sure. And he's come in and only in a few weeks, you know, he's been cleaning house. He's been getting rid of the never Trumpers. He's been getting rid of the deep state as best he can. And then here more recently, President Trump named the Texas Republican John Ratcliffe. He made a name for himself during the impeachment proceedings. Again, a very stout defender of the Trump administration. It says here, a week later, President Trump named Ratcliffe to be the director of national intelligence. Then heads really exploded. The intelligence community, particularly the CIA, probably thought they could hunker down and wait for Grenell to go away, confident that they'd have a major say in who any permanent replacement was. It says at the end of this article, when Ratcliffe is confirmed, he needs to keep that Chuck Schumer interview in mind and never, not for a second, deceive himself into believing that he can rule by anything other than fear and intimidation. In other words, okay, go get in that office and go ahead and use it the way Chuck Schumer said they were using it during the Obama years. To fight fire with fire, I presume. Here's a little bit more from that exchange that Schumer had with Rachel Maddow right at the beginning of the Trump presidency, clip 7.
Do you think he has an agenda to try to dismantle parts of the intelligence community? I mean, this form of taunting hostility.
Whether you're a super liberal Democrat or a very conservative Republican, you should be against dismantling the intelligence community.
Well, I'm not sure if he's dismantling it, but he's certainly putting in people who are loyal to him. He certainly is trying to dismantle the weaponization of these agencies. And now that the impeachment is over, he has worked with speed. Grinnell's in there as the acting director, and now he's moving through John Ratcliffe. Switching gears here over to the coronavirus. I spent a fair bit of time on this yesterday, and I think the important point to make, and I can just reiterate some of the things I said yesterday, is that we have to view this crisis through the lens of Bible prophecy, and I think that this April edition of the Trumpet magazine, The Coronavirus in Prophecy, I think that will help you to really keep things in perspective. As I was saying yesterday, when you look at the countries that have been negatively impacted by this disease, more than others, you've got China at the top, then you've got Italy. Italy's now in second. And then Iran, followed by South Korea, Spain, France, and then Germany. So basically, the people that have been hit hardest by this disease, by this infectious disease, it's the king of the south, the king of the north, and the kings of the east, with some exceptions, like I said yesterday, Russia, for example. But even that, as I was explaining, that's in the April edition. That could very easily just tip the scales in the direction of Vladimir Putin, the Prince of Rosh, heading up the kings of the East. Now, I was discussing this with Richard earlier this morning, but when you look at, I know I touched on this just briefly yesterday, when you look at the prophecy in Zechariah 6, when you look at what it says also in Amos 7 about God measuring our destruction, and this is brought out, the Zechariah 6 one in particular, it's brought out in the April edition, but you see there that God is being very precise and detailed. It's all carefully calculated. And at the moment, it's really this disease, this coronavirus, this Wuhan flu, it's really hurting the king of the south. You have all these top Iranian officials that are turning up sick. In fact, Carolyn Glick tweeted out, a tidbit today, top Hezbollah terrorists are sick with coronavirus. Terror boss Hassan Nasrallah is under quarantine. So that's the Iranian proxy. Hezbollah. They're taking a hit. Iran's taking a hit. And then, of course, you look into Europe and not far behind Italy, you've got France, Spain, Germany. And then, as I mentioned yesterday, Germany, of course, is one of the leading exporters in the world. So their economies being hit hard by this. And to this point, never mind what the Western media is doing in the United States and Britain, but to this point, the U.S. and Britain clearly have not been hit as hard as some of these other Gentile nations. The king of the South, the king of the North, the kings of the East. Now, with respect to Europe, I didn't dwell on this as much yesterday, but how will this impact the formation of the king of the North, the 10 kings, Revelation 17 and verse 12? Well, Jeremy Warner at the Telegraph this morning, he said, as if deliberately, coronavirus has hit the Eurozone just where it hurts most, Italy. And it talks about how Italy has a massive amount of debt, and compared to the size of its economy, it's carrying more debt than even the United States. I mean, that's saying something. Italy's had 600 people, more than 600, that have died so far. I told you yesterday, the whole nation's under lockdown for the most part. And the IMF, its deputy director, is estimating that Italy's going to need about $500 billion to $700 billion in bailout money just to get back on its feet. Now, you go back 10 or 12 years to all the bailouts and how that Germany at that time, we were talking about this at thetrumpet.com, Germany was really imposing its will, particularly on the southern states in Europe. And since that time, you look at the refugee crisis, and then now here we are in the midst of another crisis, and it's pounding Europe's economy. There was a story today in wallstreet.com. European bank stocks collapsed to March 2009 levels. Those are the bank stocks in Europe. It says over the past 3 weeks, stocks in Europe have plunged 22.5%, their worst decline since the collapse of Lehman Brothers. That's just in the past few weeks. So what will happen, particularly with Italy being hit the hardest? There was a piece at The Atlantic talking how that this coronavirus could be like round two of Europe's financial crisis. You had the financial crisis of 2008, and then now here we are at round two. The Atlantic says if the euro crisis a decade ago showed the risk of economic contagion, the coronavirus outbreak is contagion of a higher order. Now, keep in mind what Herbert Armstrong said about how that it would be an economic crisis. It's easy to focus just solely on the disease, but look, the crash in the oil markets, the crash in the stock market on Monday, these are all the economic considerations of this epidemic, of what could be a pandemic. But even just the scare factor, you look at the impact that it's having on the economy. This here from, Richard was just saying, he quoted from this statement from Warner. I don't have the first name, but in any event, it was in the Trumpet brief from last night. It says, Europe will be forged in crises and will be the sum of the solutions adopted for these crises. It says, although not specifically European, the crisis is another whopper threatening to expose the single currency's economic and financial fault lines anew. And then finally, it says, it may be that the EU's structures cannot withstand another recession. Alternatively, they may end up strengthened by it. My guess is the latter, that one way or another, the euro is doomed to succeed. It could have the opposite effect in that it strengthens Europe, he says. Yet another crisis that could bring together these 10 nations. And of course, it comes at a time when, as we've said in recent weeks, Germany has such weak leadership. It's got an outgoing chancellor who's been in office for years and years and years. And when the strongman hits the scene, look at what he's going to be coming into. Europe's ready. They're ready for stronger leadership. They're ready. Britain's now out, so they're ready for a stronger union. They're ready for a stronger, more unified military. You step back again, keeping in mind that April edition of The Trumpet, and see how that these events, what a year it has been. I think we made this point a few weeks ago before coronavirus even was making that many headlines. Just how much has happened in 1 year, in the first 2 months of this year. Now we're looking at the first 3 months. And that just the dramatic impact it's having on so many prophecies. Who's hit the hardest? Well, you have the King of the South, the King of the North, and the Kings of the East. And then you keep in mind the temporary resurgence. What is in the precision of these prophecies, of these punishments, like it's discussed in Zechariah 6, Amos 7, who is God holding down or holding back so that other developments can come to the fore? It's interesting to just think on the precision and the detail that goes into all of these prophecies. Well, as I say, with respect to the U.S. and Britain, they haven't been hit as hard, although here in the U.K., Britain's health minister, Nadine Dorries, she's come down with the virus, and she's been in contact with quite a few government officials. So that could have exposed or even infected quite a few prominent politicians here in the UK. There was news this morning, too, of a Premier League game. You know it's serious if they're canceling a Premier League game, particularly when it's Man City and Arsenal, as some of the Arsenal players may have come down with the virus, and now they're in quarantine. In New York, you've got the National Guard that's been called on to deliver food in a particularly hard-hit suburb of the city. We continue to hear reports coming out of Washington, Seattle, that's now banned all gatherings of over, I guess it's 250 people. So pretty much any large gathering, you can't do it, at least not now. Something to pray about, as I said earlier, with respect to the upcoming PAC in a few weeks from now. I think most of those deaths in the Washington area, Washington State, I think most of them came out from one nursing home. And of course, of the 30-some Americans that have died, I think the average age is 80 years old. So these are people who are older and more vulnerable, and in some cases, who are already sick with some kind of disease or abnormality. And so it's important, as I said yesterday, to just try to keep things in perspective. I think I saw on Fox News yesterday, or on a clip of it, that there were 26 people shot in Chicago last weekend. And this is just something that we were used to. George Friedman made the same point about automobile accidents, people killed in their car. It's like 100 a day, and we just accept it. Life is a risk, as he said. But because it's politically expedient for them to do so, you have the Democrats and the media using this to talk about President Trump's incompetence, to talk about how unprepared he is, to talk about how he's to blame, to talk about how that this is his Katrina, this is his Chernobyl, and this will, they hope, bring down his presidency. In fact, he probably, because of the decisions he made early on, banning travel coming in from China, he probably helped. This is the Jeroboam administration who probably helped to prevent this from spreading in a way that's even worse. Dr. Anthony Fauci, he's the one that had to come out last week and say, look, there's no gag order on me. He's the nation's leading expert on infectious diseases. And so he's been on quite a few programs, and he's been advising the Trump administration. This is what he had to say on Fox last night, clip 4.
Yeah, there's no question that if we had not done that in a timely way, there would have been many more travel-related cases from China. And as you know, the outbreak that we're having here in the country, this cases, originated from travel-related cases that came from China. And then we had the issue in Washington State and what we're seeing now in other states. So coming from outside within, was the thing that started it. So I think doing that saved us a lot of concern and a lot of suffering, I think.
That's Dr. Fauci saying that were it not for that travel ban, it would be a lot worse right now. And this was, again, just to remind you, this was something that the president was criticized for in January. It's racist. You can't close the border. This has been a staple of a position for Democrats for decades. You've got to leave it wide open. He closed it down and prevented the disease from spreading further. And had he not done that, this is the leading expert on infectious diseases. Had he not made that decision, well, there'd be a lot more suffering in the United States as a result. But nobody in the media, certainly nobody in the Democrat Party, is going to congratulate or thank the president and his administration for that difficult decision that was made early on. All that they will do is criticize in hopes of bringing down his administration. When we come back, we'll conclude our study, the one we started yesterday on the subject of travel and how important it is, assuming everything dies down with the coronavirus, how important travel is with respect to education. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is The Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
We have a small college, Armstrong College, Herbert W. Armstrong College, of less than 100 students spread out over two campuses, hopefully three at some point. And yet for as small as the school is, there are opportunities galore. Opportunities. Opportunities for growth, opportunities for new and exciting experiences, opportunities to help the work. Opportunities to learn God's way, opportunities to get to know God's family in a very intimate way, and of course, opportunities as well to travel. I don't have the exact percentage in front of me, but our biggest campus, of course, is headquarters, Edmond, and of the 60 or 70 students that are there, well, 30, 40, 50% maybe, come from outside the United States. So just to get to Edmond alone represents a pretty big journey for so many of our students. Then if they get there and some get to come to Edstone, or they get to go to Jerusalem for an excavation, or maybe to work at SCP in Australia or the Philippines, you add to that all the other outreach trips, and then the traveling during the fall festivals, the Feast of Tabernacles, senior trips. There are a lot of opportunities for travel, and as I said yesterday, what we want to do is make the very most of those opportunities and not just take it for granted. Because as Mr. Armstrong said, education comes from study, from books, from lectures, from contacts, from travel, from thinking about what you see and hear and read and from experience. So education comes from travel and from thinking about what you see, and it comes from experience. It's a wonderful opportunity. Travel is education, as Mr. Armstrong said. I'll just repeat one of the clips I played yesterday. This is about Mr. Armstrong going to his Uncle Frank for advice on how to proceed with his education after he had determined that he was going to get into the field of advertising. Here's Mr. Armstrong, clip 5.
But he said, if you would apply yourself and if you will study and don't have to have someone prod you on, you'll get just as good an education outside it, the world you can in. A lot of people think that education is something like buying a loaf of bread in the grocery store. You go in and order a loaf of bread and you drop, put down your money, you pick up the bread and you walk out with it. So you go into a college, you put down the money, you walk out, you got a lot of education up in your mind. It doesn't come like that, you know. And my uncle said education doesn't consist of just traipsing over his doorstep of a college classroom or sitting in an armchair. But he says it consists of study and of books and of travel and of rubbing shoulders with other people and of human dealing and of thinking and a lot of things like that.
That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his sermons back in the 1980s. As I was noting yesterday, it used to be that only the rich and powerful traveled abroad. Daniel Boorstin, in his 1961 book, The Image, he said, formerly, travel required long planning, large expense, and great investments of time. It involved risks to health or even to live. The traveler was active. Now he became passive. Instead of an athletic exercise, travel became a spectator sport. And we've seen that all through Western society, haven't we? Where we used to be active and we'd get out there and do it ourselves, and today it's just much more of the, you know, assume the position of a spectator. I mentioned yesterday how that the old English word for travel, it's the same word as travail. Travail. Traveling. Back in the day, it was labor. It was difficult. It was challenging. Boorstin says the traveler then was working on something. The tourist was a pleasure seeker. I think I gave this quote yesterday. He said, now when one risks so little and experiences so little on the voyage, the experience of being there somehow becomes emptier and more trivial. When getting there was more troublesome, being there was more vivid. When getting there is fun, arriving there somehow seems not to be arriving anyplace. Now the travel itself, it's smooth and easy and fun. You see it when people get on planes and they watch 1, 2, 3, 4 movies. And then they, as I said yesterday, they settle into a Western hotel of some sort. And they basically live just a little bit like they lived at home. It says, Americans going to remote parts of the world have been transformed from travelers into tourists by the very same advances which have made travel cheap, safe, and available. So many people can do it now. I mean, today, if you compare it to centuries ago, just ordinary citizens in the United States or here in Britain can travel like royalty, even beyond that. As I said yesterday, Abraham Lincoln never even made it outside the United States. And today we can go all over the world, but if we're not careful, we can just be a tourist instead of a travailer. The plain truth. Notice this point. This is from Mr. Armstrong's magazine back in 1984. And this author says here, I have talked with numerous business people and tourists, especially Americans, who have traveled abroad. They take their U.S. airline, stay in a luxury hotel, and eat American food. They see the cities and countryside through the large plate glass windows of a 50-passenger tour bus. A hectic 14-day schedule takes them from city to city, nation to nation. Near the end of the tour, the places they see almost, they look almost exactly like the places they have been. Sadly, only photographs and postcards serve to remind them of their trip. It says, too many people have not taken the time to know and understand the many and varied national personalities of the nations of the world. We're more connected than ever before, and yet, and you see it even within your own home country, but here we're more connected by the ease of modern travel, and yet we're more distant from one another than ever before. Education comes from travel, traveling the right way. It comes from making the most of your opportunities to travel. As I said yesterday, you really do have some outstanding examples in history. I didn't have time to talk about Shakespeare, but one of the points that Charles Ogburn makes in The Mysterious William Shakespeare is just how much of an impact Shakespeare's travels had on his writings. This is from Ogburn's book. It says, "There was not room enough for Shakespeare in the island of Britain. He had to roam far and wide in order to keep his genius supplied with raw material." It says, like Drake and Raleigh, he discovered and held as booty the material which set his imagination on fire. Between the lines and between the characters, one may read the legend, "Our island is too small, our kingdom is the world." It says, Shakespeare was, in the realm of poetry, one of the founders of British imperialism. So you see how his traveling abroad impacted his thinking, his writing. England was too small for him. He got well beyond England's shores. Now, as an aside here, of course, the main point that Ogburn makes in his book is that the Shakespeare that so many believe penned all of those masterpieces is some uneducated man who dwelt in Stratford-upon-Avon, just a few miles from Edstone here. He didn't have much education. He didn't have much interaction with nobility, and he never really traveled. He just went basically from Stratford to London, and that was it. Now, that doesn't even make sense. If you read all of his writing, if you read how he wrote about royalty, you know this was a royal family insider. This was someone who had an insatiable appetite for knowledge and for learning. This was one of the best educated nobles of his time, ever, in fact. And this is someone who traveled extensively all across Europe. This is someone that, as Ogburn brings out, someone who had a childlike curiosity for everything that he encountered. He was like the Da Vinci of his day. Of course, Da Vinci wasn't much earlier than Shakespeare. But he really had that childlike curiosity. Samuel Coleridge, he said of Shakespeare, that Shakespeare, no mere child of nature, no automaton of genius, no passive vehicle of inspiration possessed by the spirit, not possessing it, first studied patiently, meditated deeply, understood minutely, till knowledge became habitual and intuitive, wedded itself to his habitual feelings, and at length gave birth to that stupendous power by which he stands alone, it says, with no equal or second in his own class. He stands alone. He towers above, in fact, his contemporaries. He wasn't just born as a genius with very little schooling and very little experiences and very little in the way of travel. That's what they want you to think or believe about the Shakespeare that most accept as coming from Stratford. The conventional wisdom is that all that he did, he started out with a family in his early 20s, only had a few years of formal schooling, and never traveled, and didn't really know the nobility, and yet he wrote all of these masterful plays. Worse than that, Ogburn brings out how that really, if you read modern historians and what they write about Shakespeare, there's plenty of them that talk about Shakespeare as, well, he kind of borrowed this from so-and-so, or he plagiarized this from some other writer. They've got it all wrong. You look into his writings, you see the detail, you see Shakespeare's love for music, his love for animals, for birds in particular, his love for flowers. You think of Romans 1 and verse 20, God's creation, and the detail that's there to reveal God. Shakespeare also happened to have a good understanding of human nature. He had read and studied the Bible as well. One reference after another, coming straight from the Bible, says this in Ogburn's book, his love and understanding of the country are extraordinary, far deeper than that of any other poet, even in England. That's quoting from one historian, Trevor Roper. He went on to say, indeed, Shakespeare sees mankind almost as part of nature, sometimes basking in a delightful, smiling nature, sometimes caught up in a fierce, cruel, inexorable, insatiable nature. He immersed himself into God's creation. He loved it. He was observant. He observed the flowers, the birds, and so on. He was interested in music, in science. He was interested in the Bible. And he brought a lot of this out in his writings. Well, he's not alone. There's, as I say, many examples. I mentioned to the students a while back, Thomas Jefferson. He spent a lot of his years as a diplomat in France. And when he was building Monticello, his estate, finishing it out over the years, he wanted to try to bring some of French culture back to Virginia. Ben Franklin, you could say the same about him. I mentioned John Quincy yesterday, just how much of an impact traveling had on him. Henry Adams, same thing. After three or four trips to Europe, Henry Adams said, I'm taking another crack at it, educating myself. This is the way that they used to view education. Education, among other things, education comes from travel, from this kind of travel, the kind that Shakespeare did, the kind that Jefferson did. There's examples also in the Bible. Solomon, in particular, 1 Kings chapter 10 and verse 22. Notice this, it says, for the king, this is referring to Solomon, for the king had at sea a navy of Tarshish with the navy of Hiram. Once in 3 years came the navy of Tarshish, bringing gold and silver, ivory, and apes and peacocks. Here he had his navy going all over the world on these three-year expeditions and then bringing back all this gold and silver and ivory. And there's more detail as well. Solomon's crews brought back exotic animals. They brought back plants and seeds from these expeditions. And verse 23, it says, so King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom, and all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. And they brought every man his present, vessels of silver, gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, mules, at a rate year by year. This was the golden age of the ancient Israelite kingdom. And you can see how Solomon and his navy, you can see how they made use of traveling to expand the reach, the power, the wealth, to grow the wealth and the prosperity of the nation, of the kingdom. Well, when you look at what modern conveniences make possible for us, we can travel this world in ways that Solomon couldn't have dreamed of. And same with Shakespeare, and same with Jefferson. It doesn't take us 6 weeks to get from New York to London. It takes us more like 6 hours. But because it's so easy, because it's so convenient, we can just kind of live in a bubble and not really get out and appreciate God's creation like Romans 1 and verse 20 says that we should. I mentioned last week ahead of the Robbers Cave campout just how 10 minutes a day out of doors can reduce stress levels for college students. Just 10 minutes away from the machines, away from the insides of buildings, and out in God's creation, the creation that declares His glory. I'll just leave you with a few practical tips, like I did with the students a few weeks back. Goals that you can set for yourself, for your marriage, for your family. And that is, firstly, to set goals for places and sites that you or the family, the children, would like to visit. Plan ahead. This is something that, again, we can take for granted in the Church of God because we do set aside tithes to plan for fall travel. We set aside funds for, or they're subsidized in some cases, some of these activities I mentioned for college students. But there's also just personal goals that we might have through the year. Places, sites that we'd like to see and visit. I've emphasized before the importance of visiting historical sites and monuments and things of that nature. Set goals for places and sites that you'd like to visit. And then secondarily to that, set aside money, obviously. Establish a travel account so that you don't go into debt when you travel abroad, but so that you can pay for it ahead of time and then come back again, having learned from the experience. Thirdly, you can plan for your trips. Plan in advance what you're going to see, what you hope to find. I remember the first time we went in to the British Museum, we had a lecture at one of our PYCs here at Edstone, and the entire lecture was on here's what to look for in the British Museum. And if you've ever been to the British Museum, it's a massive place. And you could go in there and just get lost in the crowds of people, or you could kind of follow the crowds. They'll go over to, generally, to things that we don't consider to be that important. But unless you have a plan, you're not going to get the most out of it. You'll just end up enjoying the cafe or the coffee shop instead of the sights that are there for all to see. And some of the most exciting exhibits are off in a corner somewhere, as we learned a few years ago. They're exhibits that you have to really search for or ask questions from some of the help to find. So you have all of those options ahead of you. You've got also plenty that you can read and study about the travels of others. As I mentioned, Jefferson, Shakespeare, Da Vinci. We can study their lives and read about their travels as well. And then the last point that I can leave you with is that when you travel, and this goes back to the point that Boorstin makes in his book, when you travel, don't settle for just being a pleasure-seeking tourist. Be a travailer. Get out and into the country, the nation, the people, and get to know others and benefit from those experiences. Remember what Mr. Armstrong said about education. Among other things, it comes from travel and from experience. Well, we're about out of time, so I'll just transition right into a little bit of feedback coming from you, the listener. One individual here says, "Welcome back. You look refreshed." That's nice to know. Another one here says, "So happy to see you live again. Hope you had a wonderful time with the students." This one here says, "Hope you had a great camp out, but I got to tell you, listening to you today made me realize how much I've come to rely on you." This is in response to yesterday's show. "Your daily Bible-based account of world news is second to none. It's just a shame that more people don't tune in and grab this truth. It would change their life." Another listener says, "My workouts weren't the same without you." That's good to hear. This one from Canada says, "Good to see you back. Missed the TD yesterday." That's about the Monday program. As I explained yesterday, we had a mix-up on the time and with some of the equipment. So there was no program on Monday. But yesterday, there's already some pretty strong numbers from yesterday's show on the YouTube count. So that's good to see. But this one says, "Just a quick note on the coronavirus. We have heard that people in Calgary, Alberta have been throwing fisticuffs over toilet paper, of all things, and it has become a scarce commodity here in the lower mainland of BC. My wife asked a woman why the run on TP and the woman couldn't answer. It brought to mind a comment by a poor soul in Venezuela a year or two ago on how there was toilet paper everywhere on shelves, but no food. How sad. So many of the Latin American people have seen much hardship, and to them it's not really new. What will we see when such conditions really hit Canadians, Americans, and other Israelite nations? This one here, in response to a life filled with meaning and purpose, I think that's from last week. It says, thanks for the program. It says, the work that is written and voiced through the PCG is appreciated. I've had the same feelings for years, and I've been condemned for them, always thinking I had to be unhappy with being a miserable young person too. I had always got back to being spiritually healthy, never wanting to sin. It starts off when you are young, as I see in many ways. As a teacher or counselor would say, bad behavior bounces off. They will grow out of it, but does one truly? That's in response to the program we had last week about filling our lives with meaning and with purpose. This one here says, listening from the Twin Island Republic of Trinidad and Tobago, I have to admit the information is both inspiring and terrifying. To ponder it definitely is driving me to study the scriptures, it says, from your Bible correspondence course. Well, that's an excellent strategy or approach to take following the instruction or the news that you hear about on this program to really dig deeper into your Bible, and there's nothing better for that than the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course. That's all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.